While Pennsylvania's lawmakers say more research is needed to determine how to handle single-use plastic, some kids say the consequences are too great not to ban plastic bags.
A lot of animals mistake it for food, and they'll eat it or even just get stuck in it.
I'm Kara Holsapple, and today on the Allegheny Front, once again, young people lead the charge on an environmental problem, plastic pollution. Plus, the Amazon is burning, and that's bad for birds.
Habitat loss is the greatest threat that birds face.
And a USDA scientist was about to publicize his peer-reviewed study about the impact of carbon dioxide on the nutrients in rice. Then, higher-ups at the department had questions.
The first thing I thought was, well, this is no longer about the science. This is about somebody's ideology.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. The Pennsylvania Game Commission is teaming up with the University of Pennsylvania's Veterinary School to try and address a disease that's slowly killing deer, elk, and moose. WITF's Katie Meyer reports chronic wasting disease has been known since the 1960s, but recently appears to be spreading more quickly.
In 2012, the Game Commission started carving out disease management areas where cases of CWD were found. They now cover thousands and thousands of miles in the Commonwealth. There aren't any confirmed cases of the disease affecting people, but experts advise hunters and others not to eat meat that could be infected or handle it with bare hands. To help address the apparent spread of chronic wasting disease, Penn Vet is now dedicating 12 employees to studying wildlife diseases. They're also covering West Nile virus and white nose syndrome, which affects bats. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
Tens of thousands of fires in the Amazon continue to burn, and that's bad news for many animals, including birds. While much of the world watches in horror, over 4 million acres of rainforest in Brazil have burned as a result of a new focus on agriculture and development. Luke DeGroat is the avian research coordinator at Powdermill Nature Reserve in the Laurel Highlands, where they've been banding migrating birds for decades. I recently spoke with him about the impact these fires could be having on the birds that we see in our region. Are there birds that come through our region which spend the winter or time in the Amazon?
Yes. There's a few that use the primary forest, the rainforest, gray cheek thrushes. It's a member of the thrush family of like robins. It's a little bit smaller. It's not one you would probably commonly see. Veeries and maybe one or two other species, blackpoll warblers. And they would be spending the winter down there and migrating back through our region and heading north to the tundra in northern Canada.
The blackpoll warbler, I've heard a lot about that bird species. It's having some issues breeding. It has habitat problems here.
Both the blackpolls and the gray cheeks, they're getting squeezed on the summer grounds because with climate change, the tundra is turning more into scrub. And so they have to find breeding habitat further and further north.
What time of year do these birds come through?
So they're going to be coming through soon. In September is when we're going to be getting most of both of those species as they return back towards the Amazon for the winter.
So how will the fires there possibly impact them?
So if there's less habitat for them to use in the wintering grounds, it can be harder for them to make it through the winter and then potentially return the following spring. Those two species are one of the few that would probably use what we might think of typically is the rainforest, that primary pristine habitat. They will also use secondary forests. And most of our migrants that are coming through will use the forest that is regrowing on the edge of the Amazon or even other types of habitats. And so they will travel often in mixed species flocks looking for insects and fruit to eat over the winter.
So there'd be less habitat for them, less places for them to look with the fires that are happening there.
Yeah, there certainly could be.
Birds are incredibly mobile. A lot of the animals that are in the Amazon are not going to be able to move as quickly. Talk a little bit about that in terms of environmental disasters and birds.
So for migrants, this isn't their breeding habitat, and they're a little more flexible on the wintering grounds. And so I mentioned that these are two species that can use the primary forest, but they can also use these other areas that might be growing back up. Now, if it's agriculture, then they have very little that they can eat. But they're more adaptable. The species that are in the Amazon rainforest and the primary forest are well adapted to occupy very narrow habitats. It could be at a particular height in that canopy that they find their best food.
And the tree canopy.
The tree canopy, yeah. And so if they're really well adapted to finding particular food resources. And the Amazon rainforest isn't adapted for succession, for the changeover that we have in North America, because they don't typically have these big fires and then regrow. If that habitat is removed, those bird species simply don't have a place that they can go to because they won't have the same food that they're looking for.
Mm. How concerned are you about what's happening in the Amazon?
I'm concerned. It's complicated because in some ways this isn't a new problem. There, you know, certainly was a lot of awareness back in the 80s and 90s. I remember in high school, the Save the Rainforest campaign. Now there's been more interest in developing it. So there's been a tremendous loss. And when you look at it on that big scale, this specific round of fires, I think it's great that it's raising awareness that this is a continuing problem and that it should be addressed. And there is a concern among the scientific community that if we lose too much of the rainforest, we could reach this tipping point where it becomes more of a savanna, because the rainforest generates its own rain through the tree respiration. And so if you lose too much of that, that natural process, it breaks down.
Deforestation is happening in Brazil to make way for agriculture primarily in a lot of these cases, which has caused these fires. But deforestation is happening in other places in the world, too. How does it impact bird species and their ecosystems?
Yeah, habitat loss is the greatest threat that birds face, whether it's on the wintering habitat and the breeding grounds through climate change, or simply deforestation if we're logging more of the boreal forest and there's less boreal forest for these birds to go to. In the east, we've actually become more reforested in many areas. So in the 1800s, we went through this development period where we extracted a lot of resources. We had a lot of small-scale agriculture, and there are areas in New England that are more forested than they were maybe 100 years ago. A lot of forest habitats are preserved through national forests, national parks. It becomes more the activity and fragmentation that can be a bigger issue. So if we put in more roads to extract the logs, if we're putting in roads to frack, that fragmentation could be harmful for a lot of species. So it's not necessarily the loss of total forest, but how we use the landscape. Because in North America, a lot of areas are adapted to this cycle of fire and then reburning. There are species that require pristine forests, but there's also species that require that habitat that is growing back up. And many of those species have had the most precipitous declines, because if we aren't managing the landscape for those habitats, they may not happen on their own, especially if we're suppressing fire. It's the accumulation of all these threats that's an issue. And it isn't just habitat loss. There are other threats as well. But habitat loss is certainly the greatest threat that birds face.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Always a pleasure.
Luke DeGroat is the avian research coordinator at Powdermill Nature Reserve, which is part of the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapel. The rediscovery of a type of clover, which was thought to be extinct, proves that you should never bet against nature.
He bet me a steak dinner that was not running buffalo clover, and I got that steak dinner. So that's how it was rediscovered.
Later on the Allegheny Front, the long history and recent success of running buffalo clover. Stay tuned. Pennsylvania's lawmakers will introduce a bill this fall that aims to slash carbon pollution. But as WHYY's Dana Bate reports, even supporters of the measure admit it will take years to pass.
The bill would cut carbon emissions from the state's electricity sector 90% by 2040. To do that, the bill encourages adoption of a so-called cap and invest program, which would set a cap on the amount of carbon a power generator could emit and a price the company would pay if it went over the limit. The money generated would be used for clean energy projects and low-income assistance programs. State Senator Art Haywood is co-sponsoring the bill and says the road to passage will be long.
We've got natural gas, we've got coal. So because we have these industries in the state, it makes it much more challenging for us to get legislation that reduces emissions.
Haywood says the bill is one part of the effort to address potentially catastrophic climate change and will complement other tools like energy efficiency and renewable standards. Dana Bate, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Some local governments, eager to do something about the abundance of plastic waste, want to ban or tax single-use plastic bags. But right now in Pennsylvania, that's not an option. That's because a budget-related bill passed earlier in the summer placed a one-year moratorium on regulating single-use plastics. For State Impact Pennsylvania, Emily Pontecorvo reports on one town's bold reaction.
Council meetings in the borough of Westchester, a suburb of Philadelphia, are usually not very well attended. But on July 17th, when the council held a public hearing for a ban on plastic bags and straws, the room was packed.
Did enough states do it?
Everyone applauded after 12-year-old Kieran Schatz made a plea for banning plastic bags.
In our footsteps.
Speaking a month later, Kieran remembers how he felt.
I felt significant, like we're actually doing something, and this is because of us.
Kieran and his friends were the first to ask the Westchester Borough Council to ban single-use plastic a year ago.
A lot of animals mistake it for food, and they'll eat it or even just get stuck in it. There are some very shocking pictures as well.
The pictures Kieran's talking about include a turtle with a plastic straw stuck in its nose, and a whale that starved to death with 90 pounds of plastic in its stomach. These images and other concerns have inspired bans on single-use plastic all over the world. Kieran and his friends were excited to get support for a plastics ban from the Westchester Borough Council. But then something unexpected happened. Republican lawmakers in Harrisburg added an 11th-hour provision to a budget bill that blocks towns like Westchester from banning plastic bags for 1 year.
I definitely felt cheated. It was just gone. No, you can't do this.
The measure prevents local governments from regulating single-use plastic at all until the state finishes two studies looking at the economic and environmental impacts. State Senator Jake Corman, the Republican majority leader from Center County, spearheaded the moratorium.
I wanted to make sure educated decisions were being made on this issue. So this was a way to gather more information in a non-politically charged manner. And then we can make decisions when we get the results.
Corman's district includes a plastic bag factory, Hylex Poly, which employs about 160 people. He says Hylex tells a compelling story about their recycling program. They make retail bags with an average of 40% recycled plastic. A spokesman for the company says banning plastic bags can have unintended consequences. For example, if people can't reuse their plastic bags as trash bags, they could end up just buying more trash bags. But Westchester Mayor Diane Herron says the environmental benefits of a bag ban outweigh potential side effects. She says she's been using the same reusable grocery bags for the past decade.
If you were to do, you know, the life cycle analysis on that, there is absolutely no question that that is much better for the environment than my going to the grocery store and using single-use plastic bags every time I go.
Mayor Herron also says that under the state's Environmental Rights Amendment, the borough should have the right to make decisions like this.
There are so many instances when local governments try to protect the health, safety, and welfare of their constituents, and their hands are tied. I mean, we've seen this with pipelines coming through the backyards of our neighbors, and there's nothing they can do.
In the end, the Westchester Borough Council voted to pass the ban, with one change. They moved the start date to the end of the year-long moratorium, so it complies with current state law. But Mayor Herron and other proponents worry that state lawmakers will permanently ban plastic bag bans, like about a dozen other states have done across the country. Lawmakers in Pennsylvania tried to do this in 2017, but failed when Governor Tom Wolf vetoed the bill. Wolf cited the Environmental Rights Amendment. For Kieran and his friends, the vote to pass the bag ban in Westchester was a big win.
People were just kind of cheering and clapping. It was really great.
Westchester is second in the state to regulate plastic. Narberth already placed a fee on plastic bags earlier this year. Several other Pennsylvania towns that were planning to pass restrictions on plastic put their votes on hold until next year. But in Philadelphia, City Councilman Mark Squilla says he plans to amend his proposed plastic bag ban to begin after the state's moratorium, just like Westchester did. He hopes to have the council vote on the bill this fall. For State Impact Pennsylvania, Emily Pontecorvo.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Center for Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University. Celebrating nearly 30 years of preparing environmental professionals, the center provides multidisciplinary undergraduate and graduate education with opportunities for research and internships, including the Environmental Science and Management Master's Degree and Professional Certificate programs. Applications for the spring and summer semesters are now being accepted. More information on the Center for Environmental Research and Education can be found at duq.edu/ESM.
A top climate scientist resigned from the Agriculture Department in August. His name is Louis Ziska, and he says the USDA buried his research. For more than 20 years, Ziska published studies looking at the impact of climate change on everything from crop production and food security, ragweed and poison ivy, and most recently on the nutrients in rice. But he's one in a line of researchers who have left the federal government because they claim the Trump administration is censoring climate science. Ziska joined the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant on our podcast, Trump on Earth, to talk about why he's settling into a new job at Columbia University instead of working at the USDA.
As we mentioned, after two decades with the USDA, you recently resigned. Why? What happened?
I was growing disillusioned with the ability of my work to make any inroads with respect to dealing with the challenges posed by climate change and food security. But the proverbial straw was when I had been working with a group of international scientists from China, Japan, Australia, University of Washington, and we were looking at how rising levels of CO2, that is those that are projected by the end of this century, are going to impact rice. Rice is an important global crop. There are about 2 billion people in the world where rice is a part of their daily diets. And so what we did is we began looking at how these levels of CO2 under field conditions for about 18 different varieties of rice grown in China and Japan were being impacted. And what we found was that if you look at an integrative assessment of rice, that is to say protein, mineral nutrients like iron, as well as vitamins, we found that there were adverse effects of CO2 on reducing protein, on reducing things like iron and zinc, but also on some of the vitamins that are part of rice's profile. And then we took that information and we applied it in sort of an economic sense, so that if you are, for example, a poor country like Bangladesh, about 2/3 of your calories come every day from the rice that you consume. So what we did then is to look at, well, the 600 million figure comes from the poorer countries that rely heavily on rice as their primary food ingredient. So overall, what we found was important, and we did what we normally do. We sent a permission to be submitted. We received permission. We sent it to the journal. The journal accepted it and said, oh, and by the way, you might want to do a press release on this. So I went to the USDA communications staff. We did a press release. Everything so far was proceeding as normal. And then something strange happened. We got a response from the media people at USDA that said, oh no, the national program staff, the same program staff that approved the paper in the first place, is now saying that your data do not support the conclusions of the paper.
What happened from there? What did you think?
First thing I thought was, well, this is no longer about the science. This is about somebody's ideology that if you present them with peer-reviewed evidence that rising CO2 is affecting rice nutrition, the response should not be, oh, well, your data don't support the evidence. If they had any concerns, they should have voiced those concerns prior to the paper being submitted, which is why, you know, we sent it to them in the first place. So that indicated to me anyway that there was a paradigm shift in how science was being treated at USDA. And that's when I realized I needed to leave the agency.
We did contact the USDA. The agency has repeatedly denied having any policy to discourage dissemination of science or the use of any climate change related terms. It's been a few years. The Trump administration has been in office. How have you seen the USDA, and the treatment of climate science is different from previous administrations?
I think regardless of previous administrations, and by the way, I've worked in a number of them, both Democratic and Republican, the current administration really believes that climate change is not real. And because they believe that, they believe it's a hoax or they believe it's a liberal conspiracy, I don't know. But because of their beliefs, they're basically then shutting the science out of the normal system. You know, I worked for the Agricultural Research Service, which was the in-house arm of research. But there are other folks, such as the Economic Research Service, the National Institute of Food and Ag, that also have experts, very good people that know a lot about climate change and are willing to address these issues. But the impetus from management, from the administration to begin to do this is simply not there. And as an example, NIFA, the National Institute of Food and Ag, provides grants for all of the land-grant universities in the United States, hundreds of millions of dollars that are a fundamental aspect of how agricultural research gets done. But in the 2019 overall listing of all the projects that we're willing to support, there's no mention of climate change. There's no mention of carbon dioxide. And yet, those are not things that are immaterial. When you look at the evidence, what we currently see happening is changes in extreme events. So for the spring, for example, lots of precipitation that had not been seen in recent years. We see new diseases, new pests that are moving about because of the change in climate. This isn't, you know, theoretical. This is not an academic exercise. There are substantive issues that are affecting farmers now. And to not use what is essentially a major resource, that really does a disservice to farmers.
You know, this is a question we ask sometimes. Is there something about this that keeps you up at night?
Basically, the thing that I worry about the most is that related to population. We have almost 8 billion now. Well, we are expecting at least 9 billion by the middle of the century and 10 billion by the end of the century, maybe more. And to feed those people when the amount of arable land is declining, when resources are limited, is the number of children that will be impacted by this, the number of children that will die from malnutrition, is something that keeps me awake at night.
Louis Ziska recently resigned his position as a climate scientist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He's since started a research position at Columbia University. And he spoke with the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant on the Trump on Earth podcast. There's more of the interview at TrumponEarth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Amid the controversy around the Trump administration's new rules that weaken the Endangered Species Act, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed taking a rare species of plant off the endangered species list because it's made a comeback. Running buffalo clover is found in our region, and Glynis Board went into the woods with some experts to search for it.
It's a plant we all know and love, or we think we do. The clover. But one species of clover was thought to be extinct until someone found it in West Virginia 30 years ago. Biologist Rodney Bartkus recalls his discovery was met with some skepticism.
We were walking along the trail and I told Cloyce, hey, there's running buffalo clover. And he said, no, it's extinct. And I said, Clois, that's it. And he bet me a steak dinner that that was not running buffalo clover. And I got that steak dinner. So that's how it was rediscovered.
After Bartkus reported the find, running buffalo clover was moved onto the endangered species list. Today he's hiking with Melissa Thomas Van Gundy, a research forester with the Forest Service, stationed here at the Furneaux Experimental Forest in West Virginia. It's one place where you can find the clover.
Part of the running part comes from these stolons, these plant parts that are like a strawberry runner.
For years, Thomas Van Gundy has been helping to manage the populations of running buffalo clover found here.
Of course, it's not blooming right now, but that is a really good way to identify it.
These clover are not like the ones you find in your yard. They're much more sensitive. They can't tolerate full sun, full shade, or severe disturbance. That said, Thomas Van Gundy explains they love heavy machinery. She explains that in this particular tract of land, forest managers use heavy machinery every 10 years or so on paths they call skid roads.
When we first found this, I think it was along this trail somewhere, we said, okay, well, Fish and Wildlife Service says, you guys, we can't disturb those plants. Put your skid road up there. Don't use this skid road, okay? We did that, came back in, plant numbers had dropped where we hadn't run over them. They've showed up on the new skid road. So it's a kind of a frustrating plant if you think you have to stay off of it.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service listed the clover as endangered in 1987. Since then, more populations have been found and monitored. Today, about 150 populations are known to exist in 6 states. Many of these populations are on public lands or they're on private land with conservation agreements. Thomas Van Gundy and Bartkus say protecting these rare plants is an important part of maintaining the protective benefits of biodiversity. They say a more diverse forest is more resilient to disease, pointing out that humans ultimately depend on healthy ecosystems for clean air and water. But Bartkus says his motivation to protect the running buffalo clover is also rooted in the value of the stories it tells.
Just imagine standing right here and a herd of mastodon comes through. We know that that happened fairly routinely. That's what this, that's the disturbance making that most of these species evolved in. So, you know, once the mastodons and things like that died out, they relied upon, you know, the buffalo and the elk. So we can go back to that story. And now they rely on us.
When asked if he thought delisting the clover was a good idea, Bartkus said he felt all right about it. But the running buffalo clover isn't quite out of the woods, so to speak. Bartkus pointed to stiltgrass and other invasives that could displace more delicate native species. So it's important, he adds, to continue to keep an eye and maybe a reintroduced elk hoof on them. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Glynis Board in the Furneaux Experimental Forest in West Virginia.
The Ohio Valley Resource is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Colcom Foundation, the Park Foundation, and the Curtis and Edith Munson Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. Our Trump on Earth podcast is supported by the Robert F. Schuman Foundation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.